back to our podcast, A Country First Conversation. Today we will talk to Dr. Russell Moore, a public theologian at Christianity Today and director of Christianity Today's Public Theology Project. We'll talk about January 6th, his personal views on church and politics, and his personal struggles as he speaks out against Donald Trump in the faith community. Remember to visit our website, countryfirst.com, and share our podcast with others. Thanks for joining. Here's our host, Congressman Adam Kinzinger.
So welcome back, everybody. It's a new season of our podcast, A Country First Conversation. Today, as the season kickoff, the season opener, I'm really excited about our guest today. We're going to be talking to Dr. Russell Moore. He's a public theologian at Christianity Today, and he's the director of Christianity Today's Public Theology Project. The Wall Street Journal has called Dr. Moore vigorous, cheerful, and fiercely articulate, quite a trifecta. He was president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention from 2013 to 2021, and prior to that role, served as provost and dean of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, where he also taught theology and ethics. Dr. Moore, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, good to be with you. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. So, okay, so I want to kind of set the table here about why I'm excited to talk to you, but also what we both have in common. So you and I share a same faith. We're both Christians. We're both Christ followers. And I think the reason it's so important to explore beyond that is because the movement that we come from has played, and I think continues to play, a very, I don't know if important, but a very influential role in politics, particularly Republican politics. I think for a while, that seemed to be a decent role. You know, obviously people have different opinions on separation of church and state, but I think, you know, if you have a moral belief, putting that into practice with your public beliefs is essential and right. But you and I both have noticed something in Christianity, and I think you were onto this even a few years before I was, which was how it has gone from talking about what are the values we like, what are, you know, the things that are important to our faith, to our belief, you know, to the country, and turned in more, in some cases, into a force for culture war. And you wrote, after January 6th, you wrote an article that was titled The Roman Road from Insurrection. And in that, you reflect on what happened that day, what led to it. And as a theologian, you share that very unique perspective on the role the church has played in politics in the last few years. And of course, your message touched me on that, because like I said, I was able to identify with a lot of things you were saying. You were talking about truth, accountability, justice, integrity. So I want to dive right into it. You said in the article that you were hesitant to write it. You said you didn't want it to come across as "I told you so." So I want to ask you, what did you mean by that? Why did you decide to write that article? And talk a little about your personal struggles regarding the Trump administration, particularly prior to January 6th.
Well, I had been a Trump critic all the way back to the escalator. And in fact, before that, I was really horrified when he blasted missionaries who had Ebola. And said they shouldn't be allowed back into the country because they knew what they were signing up for.
When was that?
That was around 2013, 2014, wow. somewhere in there. And then I was very critical throughout the 2015, 2016 campaign, and am where I've always been, or more so. But I didn't want people have different views, and there were good faith, reasonable people who supported Donald Trump and didn't support everything about him. I knew that. And so on a day like that, I didn't want to come across as though I wanted to say, see, this is what I've been telling you about. I knew that wouldn't help anybody. But I had to speak to it because, for one thing, because there were signs that said Jesus saves at the insurrection. And so once again, you had this confusion between what I think is the most important thing in the universe, the gospel of Jesus Christ, and something that is, it's bad enough when it's something that's temporal. You know, there are people who confuse love of God with love of country. Okay, at least love, that's bad enough, but at least love of country is a good thing. In this case, it was a confusion of love of God and hatred of country. And so I felt the need to say something.
You know, and it's interesting. I couldn't peg whether it's 2 years ago, 4 years ago, whenever, where I came to the realization that in some people, again, as you mentioned, it's great to love your country, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you have to be blind to any wrongs the country does. It doesn't mean you have to be blind to injustices. In fact, I think you should not be blind to it, because if you love your country, you want to constantly improve it. It's like in a marriage and in a relationship, you want to constantly improve it, make it better. But I came to the realization that it seemed like a lot of folks were, I think, almost supplanting country above God or above anything else. Country was becoming an idol. And I think you see that in a lot of the verbiage out there, where it's like, if you don't love America, leave it, you know, the flag and all this stuff. And we love our country, we love the flag, but there's a fine line between being a proud American and America becoming your identity above everything else.
You know, that was what I would have said a couple of years ago. That's where I would have identified the key problem, is this confusion of the kingdom of God and the United States of America. But I've come to the conclusion that it's more than that, because what I'm seeing here is not a patriotism that's amped up. It's something else. Because again, patriotism, when it's in the rightly ordered sense of priority, is a, maybe I'm especially attuned to it today because my oldest son, who we adopted from a Russian orphanage when he was a year old, just swore in day before yesterday into the United States Air Force.
That's awesome. It's the best gig he can do.
Yeah. And standing there watching them swear in and hearing him, and the person doing the swearing in asked everybody, why are you here? And some people said to learn skills, and some people said to further my life. And my son said, to serve my country, sir.
Amazing.
And I thought, you know, my country, this is somebody who was in the former Soviet Union. Anyway, so but now what I think is going on is a lot of this, you know, we've had for years this trying to claim Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and all of the founders as though they were evangelical Christians, which is just historically not true. And you wonder why do you want to do that, to use untruth? We can say Thomas Jefferson did some great things. He wasn't our brother in Christ. And he would be the first to tell us that. Yeah. But now I think that it's not so much a hyped up love of country as it is an antagonism to perceived enemies. And that's one of the reasons why that what seems to be super patriotism can flip over to anti-patriotism really, really quickly. So you can have people talking about secession, for instance, or you can have January 6th, those sorts of things. So I think it's not the love of anything that's become disordered. It's instead a fear of the common enemy that motivates it. And that's why I think it's even more dangerous.
Yeah, it is. And I've noticed, you know, it seems like it's easy to demonize the other side. Mm-hmm. When you demonize the other side, you take their humanity away. Mm-hmm. So if you're a conservative, you know, I think there was this perception, and I think to an extent somewhat true in the past, that conservatives never got a fair shake on the media. There's no doubt about that. That conservatives, you know, we talk about what happens in the school system, cancel culture. Those are all, I think, to an extent, legitimate grievances. But what's happened is, I don't think those grievances, by the way, are existential threat to democracy. I think it's something to call out. But what's happened is, in essence, retribution has become the political identity. And the crueler you are, or the more extreme you are, the more likes and follows you get, the more you're talked about by people like you and I, or you're talked about on Twitter, that is seen as political success. Mm-hmm. And when you dehumanize the other things like secession, which Marjorie Taylor Greene recently basically, and you see this all over the kind of right is this idea of a national divorce, which is nothing but actually civil war, because frankly, the Union settled that a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I think when you, that's where the real danger is, where when people tell me, and I get this all the time, they say, Adam, you got to move on from Trump. You have to move on from January 6th. Why are you serving on the January 6th committee? I say, well, look, part of redemption, part of forgiveness, part of healing, you know, making yourself whole, is to recognize the failure, not to dwell on it, but to recognize it and kind of in your heart motivate to do better.
Yeah.
We haven't done any of that. In fact, since January 6th, I would argue that we're even more divided.
Oh, absolutely.
And, yeah. And, you know, you talked about the idea of the I told you so, you know, and you didn't want to come across like that. This is a problem I think that exists. And I want you to comment on this if you've seen it among people or felt it, because I have. So in 2016, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And my weakness, and I will admit this any day, is I did vote for him in 2020 and I regret that. But the reason I did it was because I went through so much crap for not voting for him in 2016. I figured it would just be easier to vote for him and say I did and avoid that. And that's to my shame. And obviously I think after the election too, was the real threat to democracy was evident. But the problem is you can see it on Twitter. You see it in what people say, particularly on the left, where they're like, well, where were you 3 years ago? Where were you 5 years ago? Why don't you address that? Because you were there early, but you don't take that approach.
That is the most self-destructive thing. I mean, how in the world can we expect people to join together when what we say is, if you're not here from the very beginning, then you're not, then we don't want you. And I've seen that in other areas as well. That's happened in the pro-life movement. Where sometimes you will have someone who is moving toward a pro-life position and starts to recognize the humanity of the unborn child. And someone will say, yeah, but what about back in 2012? Or what about back such and such a year? Well, I mean, then you don't have a pro-life movement or you don't have whatever movement you're asking for. And at a time when you're saying, folks, democracy really is in jeopardy. If all that we have are the people who have always seen that and always said that, then we're actually working for the anti-democracy forces. I mean, that's insanity. And I see that all the time about you or about Liz Cheney or other people. Yeah, but what about the fact that they voted for Trump in 2020? Or isn't that what we're trying to do, is to appeal to one another and to seek to persuade one another? I mean, it's self-defeating, and it's part of this really unserious time that we live in, where people are just living this out on the right and the left and the center, living this out like a video game rather than what's really at stake. And I think people have this idea that sometime at the last minute, the grown-ups are going to step in and save us all from this like they always have before. But we're the grown-ups, and we're the ones who are supposed to be pulling this out of the ditch, and we're waiting for someone else.
You know, that the guy that founded Operation Pineapple or Pineapple Express, Operation Pineapple, I listened to his podcast, and I don't know if he agrees with my politics or not. Frankly, doesn't matter for this, but he always talked about that theory that nobody else is coming. Mm-hmm. And that was a realization to me too, because, and that'll get into kind of another thing I want to talk about with you, but the realization where I in 2017, I think you wrote something about telling your wife that you feel like you're alone in essence in this. Yeah. And I can identify with that feeling. Obviously, in the last year, it's been Liz Cheney and I. And in fact, instead of it seeming, now Country First as a movement has grown really quickly, which I'm very appreciative and grateful for. But in Congress, I mean, not only has it just remained Liz Cheney and I, the people that I thought would eventually come around have kind of hunkered in the basement to hope that magic person comes along on the steed.
Yeah.
But the Operation Pineapple guy, I always had that term about nobody's coming. And I think that too helped motivate me to say, I can't run again because of a whole host of factors. Redistricting, I will have been in 12 years. I want to focus on this broader movement, but I got to stay in the fight for the rest of my time in Congress and beyond, because right now, you, me, the listeners, you know, Liz Cheney, we are the people that are coming. And it's not to build us up. It's actually a sad state of where we're at. Yeah. But, you know, as you and I have taken on tribes and tribes in our own, what we would consider identity, we've come around to have to recognize that standing alone, while it's heroic in every history book you read, it's actually really hard.
Yeah, it's so really hard.
I'm curious how you've dealt with it. Obviously, you famously or infamously, or I guess popularly, you know, had to resign from the Southern Baptist Convention because of what you went through, or better to say, you moved on. Share your story a little bit and kind of how you've dealt with that.
Yeah, I didn't have to leave.
Right.
Most people were very supportive. As a matter of fact, every year when we would go to our annual convention, 99% of the people were affirming and loving. So it wasn't that. It was that there were people who will do anything. And the problem is not that there are a lot of those people. The problem is that everybody else thinks, well, if we just get really quiet, this will all work itself out and settle itself down. And that's one of the things that I would say in the 2016, 2017 years and beyond, feeling that sense of aloneness. The reason I felt so alone is not because there were people who disagreed with me on Trump or Christian nationalism or whatever. I actually can have a measure of respect for, say, a Robert Jeffress, who's very, very different from me. But he, I think, really believes this and has said that all along. What really troubles me are the people who agree with me in private and disagree with me in public.
Yes.
And I think we've both had that, that go on. And that was one of the things I worried about at the time, because, you know, I said that there were reasonable people who would say, well, I'm going to vote for Trump because, as a friend of mine said, I'm not voting for one person. I'm voting for thousands of people in an administration. And so about a year in, I said to him, well, those 1,000 people are gone. Are the next 1,000 okay with you? As we keep whittling through them. But that idea of lesser of two evils, what I worried about is that would not hold. And indeed, it did not. So you didn't end up with people who are saying, well, I was voting against Hillary Clinton, but we're not going to allow this, and this to take place. No, instead, it was baptized and it became something that was to be defended. And so the Trumpism actually changed the supporters rather than the supporters changing the Trumpism. And that's what I worried about. And not because of Trump particularly, but because that's the nature of American politics. I mean, if you go back and you say, where are you on the Iraq war in, say, 2007, it largely depends on what political party you're in. It's just whether or not you like George W. Bush. And so, you know, one of those positions may be the right position, but it's how people get there. And that's what I worried about in this case. And that's exactly what happened. And that's why when I say I didn't want to say I told you so, it was because I'd sort of already been through that. When the Access Hollywood tapes came out, I said to myself, you know what? Nobody can support this. And everybody's going to start lining up against this. And some of them did, and then pivoted right back. And then many more of them did. When the difference was not some sort of, oh, we found out that that tape really doesn't exist, or, oh, we find out that Donald Trump has gone through this this repentance and restoration. No, it was just that he won.
Right.
That's what made it different. And so when January 6th happened, I knew that eventually, and it would take a little while, you think about after Access Hollywood, it took about 3 days for people to really know how to talk about this in a way that could wave it away. It's locker room talk. That's what it was settled on. as. And I said, the same thing will probably happen now. And it did. And it shifted from thing to thing. So for a time it was, oh, well, these weren't MAGA people. These were Antifa people. And then when that was proven to not be the case, it's, well, they really didn't happen at all. It was just a group of peaceful people and kind of got out of hand. I mean, look at the videotape. We have this, but that's the settled on opinion. And that's what I think is so dangerous in the American Republic right now.
You know, it's interesting because it's what I think one of the biggest threats. And I actually, the person that brought this specific word to my head was Arthur Brooks from formerly the AEI, and now he's a Harvard professor and but writes a lot about happiness. Mm-hmm. But he said, I gave him my, we were talking on the phone, and I'm sure he doesn't mind me sharing this. And we were talking about what's the biggest threat, that kind of stuff. He goes, look, Adam, the biggest threat, and maybe it was actually you that told me this, I don't know. The biggest threat is truth. The biggest loss to this country is the loss of truth. And I remember as a kid going to Sunday school, being told repeatedly the importance of truth, being told repeatedly that regardless of your opinion, the truth is still a baseline we work by. Mm-hmm. That truth is dead. Now, truth isn't dead in reality, but truth, right, particularly in politics, and I think it's creeping into other people's life, is dead, where the truth isn't that January 6th was an insurrection that was largely created by people that falsely convinced folks that you could overturn a legitimate election, that the election was legitimate, et cetera. And that's why you can so easily unmoor yourself and move around from theory to theory. It was Antifa. The next day, it was actually the most patriotic thing that's ever happened in this country. The next day, it's this, it's that, because we're unmoored from truth. Yeah. And that, as a Christian, is concerning to me. That, as a political leader, is the thing that I think could actually lead to the destruction of this country in the long or short run. What do you think about that?
I think it's very dangerous, and not just to the country. I think it's deadly dangerous to the church. And I say that as someone who went through, as a 15-year-old, a really hard spiritual crisis, because I started to suspect, well, maybe this is really about politics. Maybe the Sunday school is really just about politics, that's what is at the end of this well, or Southern culture or something like that. And thankfully, there were the writings of C.S. Lewis and other people to pull me through that, pull me out of that, and see a bigger vision of the church. But that was a real fear that I had. Now you have an entire world of people who are, and some of them our own children, who are sitting in pews every week and who are seeing people saying and doing the opposite of what they taught them, without any reason why, other than we hate this particular group of people, whoever that is, that creates a sense of cynicism in some people. Can't trust anything. Everybody's just playing you. And in a group of other people, despair. I've heard from, I can't tell you how many young evangelicals who said, I've walked away from the church and I never wanted to, but I can't see how what they're saying to me, not just with the political stuff, but with the conspiracy theories and other things, how I can be there. And I'm having to come in and say, wait, look at the church, capital C, over that spans space and time. Look at Jesus. Let's concentrate on that. But it's a real crisis. And that's playing itself out at every level. I mean, I was one of the problems, I think, is, and I sort of learned this in my own experience, and I think you probably did too, is that it takes a certain kind of person to be willing to live in this sort of environment. So there's a really good book called Corrupted that came out this year that was arguing it's not that power corrupts people, it's that corruptible people seek power. They're the people who want it. And so this author gave the example of his mom, who ran for the school board because she cared about kids, she cared about education. Now, he said, if she knew that being on a school board meant that she was going to have to be screamed at over mask policies or over critical race theory or whatever, she wouldn't run. She would just say, okay, but that's, I'm not a contentious, quarrelsome person. That's just not what I enjoy. And so she wouldn't do it. And that would leave the people who actually don't want to govern, but really do want to get red-faced on TV. That's what's left. And so that's happening. That's happening in the political sphere. It's happening in the religious sphere. I'm hearing every day from pastors who are saying, I'm about to quit ministry. And then you see people who are building ministries off of COVID's a hoax. The vaccine is a plot, you know, those sorts of things. And you realize that is really a perilous situation.
It really is. And if you look at, you know, if you look at the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament, with the exception of basically render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, he basically makes it very clear, I'm not here to change the government. Now, that doesn't mean as a believer, as a Christian, whatever your faith happens to be, that you cannot be involved in government. I frankly think you should. I think it's an okay, it's a good, you know, ministry, if you will, or job to get into. But to then say, if you're a church leader, to take that and say, our job is now to change government. Our job as a church is to make sure we're making that impact. That to me violates, in essence, everything that Jesus said the church is to be, because it's more about the church is a collective body. It's not a building. The church is about changing souls. It's about ministering to people. It's about outreach, you know, helping the poor, that kind of stuff. And it feels like people have lost that in the church. And I don't say, again, the churches I attend, they stay away from politics, except very important issues. When we had racial issues, particularly, you know, summer ago, but the problem is it seems to be an increasing amount that just kind of get that fulfillment on anger. And that's what I think is very clear we shouldn't be using.
Well, and what's happening is, and you can see this all around the world, where people are, authoritarian movements are using religious bodies because of what you can gain from that is a sort of unquestionable authority. And so you have this happening in England, you have it happening in France, you have it happening in the Netherlands and other places. A scholar named Tobias Creamer writes about this really, really persuasively, and talks about how you can go to France, you see the person with the Joan of Arc statue or a placard, or you can go to Germany, Keep Germany Christian placard. You talk to those people, they're atheists. And what they mean by Christianity is our shared cultural symbols that bind us all together as an ethnic blood and soil sort of contingent. And that is deadly dangerous, not only in terms of what it does in the public arena, but also what it ultimately does to the religion, which is to, now, I'm not worried about whether or not the church survives. Church will survive because Jesus promised that it would, Caesarea Philippi. But that doesn't mean that the American church will survive. And it doesn't mean that the American church won't, as the churches in the book of Revelation, lose the lampstand of the presence of Christ. I mean, that is a real danger. And it's also a real danger when people view religion as just a cynical means of getting to politics. I mean, you saw this on the left. In the 1960s and 70s, some mainline denominations became not just, they sort of moved from applying their religion to the political sphere to actually being about the politics, left-wing politics. And so Carl Henry, who was an old evangelical theologian, used to say these mainline denominations aren't sure whether or not the Bible's inspired, but they do have a comprehensive energy policy. And so that started happening. Well, what happens? You end up with the next generation realizing, okay, well, if energy policy is what we're about, we can get to energy policy and we can deal with that without having to give up a Sunday morning. So the religion just becomes a means to an end. You saw that on the left, and now you're seeing it on the right. And it's destabilizing and dangerous.
Well, let me ask you, so, you know, you have stood not alone, but you have stood, you know, among a few from early on saying truth. In that process, you know, I'm sure there have been moments of doubt. I can tell you in my case, there are nights where I've laid awake, where I've talked to my wife and said, you know, sometimes I just wonder if I'm doing the right thing, because how in the world can I be the, you know, how can so many others be wrong and just me or just a few of us are right? But I am convinced when I go back to my core beliefs, when I go back to the thing I said when I ran for Congress that I would be true and faithful to, it reaffirms me, you know, my relationship with God reaffirms me. And I know there's a lot of people. So the folks that listen to this podcast, some are on the left, some would be not identified or they'd be in the center, and some are on the right, but they all kind of share our belief that something is horribly wrong. And we have to try to find the ability to stand alone, to grow our numbers and to unify. What is it that you have determined that has helped you through those moments of standing alone? And what kind of advice would you give to the listeners in how do we, how can we find hope and move forward and actually fight and win this battle?
Well, I had a sense from the very beginning, and I was like you. Many times I've said, am I crazy? And I say that often to people that I know. It's I have to just question, am I insane? Or are we living in an insane time? But I was convinced from the very beginning of what happened to the prophet Elijah when he thought he was standing alone and went out into the wilderness. He was under threat of his life. And he said, I and I alone am left. And the response from God is, you're not alone. There's 7,000 that are out there, but he doesn't show them who they are. And he talks about the future. And so I think there has to be in any life a short-term loneliness for a long-term community, and that's what happened. I mean, the white pastors in the Jim Crow South who said segregation is wrong were completely alone. They lost their pulpits, but they were able to retain their integrity to be able to speak to people who are wondering, is this real? And so you sometimes have to have that. And one of the things that is so grievous in this, we all have people who were our very good friends who are gone, you know, who don't want to be seen. You know, might be glad to be seen with you in private, but don't want to be seen with you in public. That really hurts and bothers me. Until I start thinking about what kind of community has been formed with people who I never thought that I would love and know and work with, and that's what I mean, there was an older Jewish human rights activist who told me about a completely different thing years ago. He said, you know, people think that these coalitions are about the issues, and they are, but it's really the other way around. What happens is you start working together in this one area, you know, breaking internet firewalls in totalitarian states or something like that. And you start realizing we actually share a common commitment to something really important. And that often creates its own sort of things. And I think that's happened in this moment as well. I think you have a pro-democracy movement of people who never would have seen each other as allies. And you have specifically within the evangelical Christian world, a gathering of people who say, you know, maybe some of the people that we thought were with us aren't, but there are a lot of people out there who also want Kingdom First. And so I think that that's part of what ought to motivate us.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I think about it like I would have been reading your stuff. Had none of this happened, you know, I would know who you were. I'd read your stuff. You may or may not know who I am in politics. I probably wouldn't be as high profile as I am now because it's not by choice. But now you and I are good friends and we've had conversations that I think they've certainly been helpful to me. And I appreciate that. And I think it's interesting, you know, this is one of the hopes that I hope we get to eventually is, I think the most asinine thing to actually make your friend based off of is your political identity. I mean, let's think about how ridiculous it is. You want lower taxes or you want higher taxes. Therefore, I'm going to be your friend. Yeah. Now, you may make a friend in your advocation of higher or lower taxes, but that has become our sole friend group. And no longer, that's why even I, you know, I don't know all my neighbors where I live because people don't venture out anymore. It used to be when I was a kid, you know, I had a neighbor that was a police officer, a neighbor that worked at country companies, a neighbor that, you know, was a huge Democrat. We were all friends. Nowadays, it's based on something different and that community needs to be restored. And I think maybe that's going to be the good thing that comes out of this is we recognize the value in each other because we certainly are kind of scraping the bottom of where we can survive. And
And I think one of the things you also see is that when those friendships and relationships and alliances are built on politics alone, the really disturbing thing is not just that it's a matter of you have to share my politics and be my friend. That's bad enough. It's that you have to change your politics when we're told to change our politics and change your theology when we're told to change our theology. And so you can be where you've always been. I'm more or less in the same place I was in when I walked down the aisle and surrendered my life to ministry in 1994. But the requirement is you have to be willing to not just sign up for this set of political ideals, but for any future political ideals that we may give to you.
That is so true. I've often wondered how I'm like, you know, my view on guns has changed slightly. I'm still very pro Second Amendment, but I want background checks and, you know, but other than really that, I'm generally the exact same political person, but somehow in the last 11 years, I have become a rhino, you know, and it's like, okay, and I'm fine with that. Doesn't hurt me, but, and I think too, you know, and this is, and I'll kind of wrap up on this and appreciate you being generous with your time. And when I look at, you know, the people I know in Congress, for instance, and I'm curious if you feel the same way about the ministry and the Christian movement, you know, that I look and I go, okay, we make $174,000 a year. It's not a bad salary, but you know, you're buying houses in two places. It's you're not going to get rich. Why in the world would you put up everything you believe in, everything for the moment and for that salary and the fear of losing or being put out when I think history is going to look back, certainly, and not say that those that believed in insurrection, those that wanted to nationalize the Christian movement was the right way. And it's amazing because we often think about all these heroes in the past. And I guess now I have just a small taste from those that have stood alone and done things, just a tiny taste, I'm not comparing myself to them, of how hard it can be to actually do that. And I think for everybody out there, you know, there is benefit if you feel like you're standing alone, but sticking to your principles while payday may not come now. And that feeling of not vindication, that's the wrong word, but I did the right thing may not come right now. It will come. And I think history will judge you well. And I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things for me is that I really believe that I'm going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account for my own life and conscience and to act against my conscience and my principles it's not something I can just sort of work my way through. Someone knows what's taking place. And the other thing is, I have kids who are watching to see, do you really believe what you say you believe, or is this just useful to you? And so that kind of refocuses. One of the things that I say, I get this question all the time from young Christians who say, should I go into politics? I spent a semester on campus University of Chicago teaching in the Institute of Politics there. And there would be all of these young Christians who would say, I'm kind of politically homeless because I'm not an ethno-nationalist. I'm also not a progressive. And so should I go into politics? And we would try to work that through. But others who would say, I would often say to them, if you, the only people who should go into politics are the people who are willing to lose an election and still have a life to live. Because yeah. The people that you see who were always running for student government president since the fifth grade, and who have to have that sort of life or else they have nothing else, that becomes a really, really perilous place, not just for the policy, but it becomes perilous to their own souls and their own character. And I think we've seen that with a lot of people. And so if you have to be elected and to serve in or to be reelected, don't run, is what I would say. Be the person who's willing to lose and to know there are certain things that I would lose for.
You know, it's interesting. When I came back from Iraq in 2009 and I announced I was running for Congress, the thing I made the commitment to myself and to God, frankly, is that I would be willing to take a career-ending vote. Mm-hmm. And that has to be the thing that drives me. And it's funny, I would have assumed it would have been like reforming Social Security or something like that. Yeah. I didn't know it would be impeaching a president of my own party and defending democracy, but I feel way more at peace than if I wasn't. And I appreciate everything you've said in that quick plug, by the way, on the Country First website, country1st.com, we have some politically homeless gear. So you said politically homeless, so people can go on there and label themselves as politically homeless.
That's great.
Well, Dr. Russell Moore, thank you for your leadership. Thank you for your friendship for me personally and your mentorship. And I know the listeners appreciate the time you've taken. Your Twitter is at Dr. Moore, M-O-O-R-E. And I'm not sure if you have a website or anything you wanna plug at all. And
it's just russellmoore.com and christianitytoday.com.
Yeah, and read his stuff and you'll see that regardless of what your personal faith is, when it comes to, if your only interest is the politics of it, he does a great job of kind of bringing people back to what truly matters. And I appreciate your friendship, Dr. Moore. Thank you for spending the time.
Likewise, I appreciate your friendship and I'm thankful for your service to our country, especially on the January 6th committee, which is of utmost importance right now.
Well, thank you. Dr. Moore, God bless you. Have a great new year.
You too.
Thanks.
This has been a Country First Conversation with Adam Kinzinger and Dr. Russell Moore. Thank you for joining today. The Country First team wants to hear from you, so please be sure to share in the comments or send us a note at info@countryfirst.com to share your thoughts. And be sure to visit countryfirst.com for our other podcast conversations. And be sure to subscribe to receive all the latest updates.